It's the weekly news roundup, and there is a lot to talk about. Welcome to the full story on WSHU. I'm Ron Ropiak. There was plenty of news out of Washington and Vietnam this past week, the same in our region. Coming up, we're going to get the Connecticut perspective, and also Karen DeWitt will be joining us to give us the view from Albany. But to start, let's bring in Alfonso Castillo. Alfonso is Newsday's transportation reporter. He's been nice enough to spend some time with us in the past talking about the LIRR, how to improve service on the rails, fare hikes, and so on. But today it's a little bit more grim. As you probably have heard, three men died the other day when the car they were in got hit by two LIRR trains in Westbury. Alfonso, thanks once again for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure, Ron.
How'd this happen?
Well, police say that these three gentlemen got involved in a car accident near the crossing and were actually leaving the scene of it when they went around gates that were downed. They were first struck by a slow-moving eastbound train that had just left Westbury Station, and that caused the car to spin out and then get hit by another train that was coming in the other direction, which is moving much faster. I think that's the one that did most of the damage. The car ended up being sandwiched between the two trains. It burst into a fireball, and all three occupants inside were killed. Then two cars of that, that westbound train, the front two cars, derailed, struck the concrete platform at the station. And that was really scary, too. If you see some of those photos, there was concrete and rebar right into the engineer's cab. The engineer, you know, approaching the platform, ran out of the cab for cover and really saved himself when he did.
And you mentioned that there are photos, and like many other things nowadays, there's video of it.
Yeah, it's horrifying stuff. I don't think I've seen a video, but I was there Tuesday night. You got the call and rushed over to Westbury and saw the aftermath. And a terrifying sight. I mean, I've been covering this beat going on 11 years, and thankfully haven't seen too many of those. But this one is as scary a one as I can recall in our area here on Long Island.
What's it like in the community there? What are you hearing from everyone?
Well, you know, these three men worked at a local grocery store, and we've had reporters who have visited there in the last couple of days. Obviously, a lot of grief. The depictions of these three men were hardworking, family people, friendly, you know, all good things to say about it. But what officials from the area have said is that they made a really bad decision. You know, we're working on a story here, me and a colleague of mine, about grade crossing safety. And, you know, suffice to say, it's incredibly dangerous to drive around downed gates at a crossing. And yet, you know, it continues to happen all the time. A lot of discussion about how to make crossings safer. Your newscast there just talked about one bill being proposed that would essentially kind of set up red light cameras that would automatically issue summons to drivers who go through down gates. But, you know, some people make the point that no amount of engineering enforcement will stop somebody who wants to do this from doing it, short of eliminating these crossings altogether. And that's, you know, ironically, they're doing that with seven crossings, including the one where this accident is happening. It's pegged for elimination next year, but those projects are very few and far between and incredibly expensive.
I was reading all the excellent coverage you've been doing in Newsday, and the idea about the red light cameras struck me as a no-brainer. Just anything that could be done at this moment to dissuade people from doing that just seems like it should be done instantly.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of consensus that would go a long way. I mean, you've seen it change behavior at red lights when they set up automatic enforcement at school zones a while back. You know, you saw people slow down there too. You would think if motorists knew that at every railroad grade crossing, there's a camera, and that you'd get hit with a ticket if you went around that gate. You think that would change behavior. The flip side of that, as I understand, and because bills like this have been floating around in Albany for years and have never been acted upon, Senator Thomas is not the first one to propose something like this. Maybe now it's going to have the momentum. But the issue has always been, like those red light cameras, like the school zone enforcement, they're really unpopular because people are going to get hit with those tickets, you know. But I think maybe different than even those two instances. In this instance, the person you're really looking out for is the driver himself, you know, the person who goes around the gate more than anybody's putting himself and his passengers at risk. I mean, what you saw here was even looking at the devastation of that accident, there were only minor injuries on the train. And it really speaks to what happens when a train hits almost anything. At a crossing, it's really just kind of a minor obstacle in its way, a tin can. I mean, you're talking about these things that weigh, you know, dozens of tons coming at a vehicle. You don't stand a chance. And I mean, you would think that knowing that you were going to get, that there was some kind of financial disincentive, right, getting hit with the ticket would make a difference.
Alfonso, you know, I have to tell you that when I've been on some platforms in the past, and not recently, but a number of years ago, and on the New Haven line here in Connecticut, and I would see people running across the tracks at times if they want to save time or whatever. And it goes back to what you said before. If someone really wants to do it, if someone wants to get around the gates, if someone wants to cross the tracks, I mean, how much can you do to stop them? Besides, as you said before, possibly making the road go underneath.
Yeah. The pedestrian issue is another one that I guess hasn't been talked about too much here. And a lot of these engineering fixes, you know, you hear things about longer gates or some kind of barriers in the roadways or even the tickets. Those really target cars that go through crossings. But you're right. There's a huge problem at a lot of crossings with pedestrians, commuters themselves, right? So with a lot of these crossings, you get off your train, you're in a rush to get in your car and get back home, but because the crossing is active, you gotta wait on the other side of the crossing until it's all clear, and it could take a long time. People get impatient, you know, they look both ways and they think it's clear enough and they go across. And I just spoke with a gentleman yesterday in Bethpage who, over the last 20 years or so, personally witnessed three people get killed, pedestrians get killed at his local train station. Incredibly dangerous. You touched on it. You know, what I hear all the time is the only safe crossing is an eliminated crossing, no crossing at all. But these projects, again, hugely expensive. They're in the neighborhood of $100 million. It requires, as you touched on, either sinking a road under the tracks or building a bridge over tracks. Big infrastructure projects. They often require taking private property. And, you know, I think over the last 20 years or so, they've done one or two. And they just don't happen very often. And I don't believe any more are other than the seven that they're doing with the third track project, which is a lot. Again, when you talk about two in the last 20 years, doing seven at once is a big deal. But here on Long Island, there's close to 300, and many of the most dangerous ones, there's no plans to eliminate.
We have about 2 minutes left. So, Alfonso, where does it go from here?
Well, the investigation is continuing. One of the victims has not yet been named. Their DNA test that we're told will take about a week to get back. Thankfully, I mean, certainly heard some praise from commuters who, you know, from talking to you, you know, they're a very cynical bunch, and a lot of good words about the railroad's response in restoring service. They were up and running with some service through there the very next morning, and within 48 hours, were pretty much back to full service, despite something like 200 feet of tracks being destroyed. Again, part of the concrete platform was destroyed, and they were able to get back up and running with these crews working around the clock. There's actually later this afternoon, a pretty important Senate hearing here on Long Island on the topic of the Long Island Railroad. This was scheduled a while back to discuss the railroad's performance. LIR, you know, had a really rough year last year, but so much has happened this week, from the accident to earlier this week, there was a fare increase. There was this 10-point plan announced by the governor and the mayor of New York here to restructure the MTA. There's another development on positive train control and another big delay that they've run into. So it is as crazy a week as I can remember on this beat. And I imagine this will all be topic of discussion at this public hearing in Mineola later today.
And not only that, the whole thing with congestion pricing in Manhattan and some of those funds going to improve the subways, and the Long Island delegation saying, you know what, if that takes place, we want some of that money to come out here and improve the LIRR.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, you know, some stories broke, you know, 3 days ago, 4 days ago, and it feels like an eternity ago with how much has been going on this week on the MTA LIR beat.
We always appreciate your time. We know this has been a heck of a week, and thanks for taking a few minutes to talk with us.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks, Alfonso. Alfonso Castillo is the transportation reporter for Newsday. This is our weekly news roundup on the full story. Coming up, we're going to be spending a few minutes with Karen DeWitt, who is WSHU's Capitol correspondent in Albany. And in the studio with me, they're busy typing away, Dan Haar and Ken Dixon from Hearst Connecticut Newspapers, and we'll be talking everything Connecticut and the Lamont administration. It's the full story on WSHU. A short break. We'll be right back. This is the full story on WSHU, and we continue with our weekly news roundup. Karen DeWitt is our Albany correspondent. She follows everything going on in the state capitol. Hi, Karen.
Hey, Ron.
So, number one, Governor Andrew Cuomo is making a move to save the Amazon deal. What's going on with that?
Yeah, the governor just does not want to let go of this. He was pretty much blindsided a couple of weeks ago on Valentine's Day when Amazon abruptly pulled out of the deal that would have created possibly 25,000 jobs in Long Island City, Queens. And the governor's been really been simmering and, you know, very angry ever since, blaming Senate Democrats. The Senate Deputy Majority Leader Michael Gianaris represents that area of Long Island City, Queens, was against the project. And now the governor isn't giving up. It's been reported at first in the New York Times that Cuomo has been talking to Jeff Bezos, Amazon's owner, and he's essentially kind of begging him to come back, saying, look, it'll be different this time. I'll personally, you know, shepherd the project through. You'll get what you want. You'll get what you need. They even took out a full-page ad in the Times today, and he got a letter that's sent around with, you know, many union leaders, many local leaders. But, you know, here's the thing, Ron. The people that are opposed to the project or were, they haven't really changed their minds on this. So I don't really see what's changed that Amazon would want to come back. Because the local progressive groups are still against it. You have AOC, as she's called, our new congresswoman, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, is against it. So I don't really see that the political dynamics have changed, other than the Senate Democratic leader, Andrew Stark-Cousins, issued a statement yesterday kind of saying, well, I'm not really against the project. We'd like to talk. But I don't know what the incentive is for Amazon to come back. But you got to give Governor Cuomo credit when he like gets his mind focused on something. He doesn't give up.
It's I have to say, I was reading the press reports about it, and the governor was saying that it was a vocal minority who stopped the deal. He sounded angry, and his press people, they actually sound pretty confident now that they can get this done.
Well, they need to sound confident, I think, in order to try to lure Amazon back. But who knows? I mean, this is not just a New York thing. Amazon announced this week they were pulling out of a big office building in Seattle, apparently because they weren't happy with some of the regulations and internal politics in Seattle that might have been a hassle for them. So it sounds like they've just kind of made a decision that if there's going to be a hassle with anywhere we expand, we don't need this in our lives. There's plenty of other places we can go. So I still don't see how you totally overcome that, but it's certainly interesting, and it's certainly overshadowing just about everything that's going on at State Capitol right now.
You had a story the other day which gave me pause, and I think it should do the same for others, because at a meeting up in Albany, some economists were warning that there's a good chance that a recession's going to hit in the second half of 2020, next year. And they're warning, get ready for it now.
Yeah, and these were major nationally respected financial advisors and economists, including Hugh Johnson of Hugh Johnson Advisors, people from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, saying, look, we think the stock market, it has, you know, come back a little bit since last December, but it's going to peak in the first quarter of 2020. And then because of a lot of global factors, because of the national debt growing, probably the second half of 2020, there's going to be a recession. There's still be growth, but it's going to be, you know, at a lower rate than what we've been, you know, experiencing in the last few years. And so essentially they were telling the budget makers, don't get too crazy with all this spending. And some of them were also saying, and don't, you know, raise taxes on the wealthy any further than you already have that millionaire surcharge. Because the wealthy are getting squeezed and they're really going to, you know, suffer the impacts of the recession. And you New York State budget makers, and we do in New York, depend a lot on, you know, disproportionately on the very wealthy to fund, you know, a lot of state programs.
Just as an aside, we had Governor Ned Lamont on the program yesterday, and that was one of my questions for him about whether he was going to raise taxes on the wealthy, and he said no. But I know that there are some progressives in Hartford who are still pushing for this, and it'll be interesting to see how that shakes out over the next month or two.
Yeah, well, that's the same in New York State with the new Democrats in the Senate. There are a lot of Democrats in the legislature that do think that there shouldn't be a surcharge just on millionaires. There should be even more upper income brackets if you make more than $10 million, if you make more than $100 million, or if you make more than $1 billion in a year, then you should pay a higher rate on taxes. And the state assembly, which has been led by Democrats for years, has passed that bill many times in a row. So it could be that could be a tension point between Governor Cuomo, who really doesn't want to do that, and the legislature as the budget talks heat up over the next month.
Now, the governor and Mayor de Blasio, who seem to be best friends nowadays, they're once again teaming up to back a congestion pricing plan for Manhattan. It's an idea that's been around now for a long time. But there are signs it could have a better chance of passing this time. What's the mood in Albany?
Well, I mean, there is support for it, but then you have the suburbs, Long Island, people who live in Connecticut, people who live in the Hudson Valley, and those senators, some of them are newly elected Democrats from Long Island, are kind of wary of this because it's their constituents that are going to pay the price. It's not going to be the people living in Manhattan, and maybe not even as many in the outer boroughs because there's a lot of public transport that they take. So I don't know how that's going to shake out, because it's going to be tough for these newly elected Democratic senators from Long Island to just come in and say, hey, you know, we approve congestion pricing, and now every time you need to go to Manhattan, you're going to have to pay quite a bit more money. And so that's another tension point.
And I know the Long Island delegation, they basically want some skin in the game. They're saying, look, if you're going to make us pay for this, then some of that money should be coming out to the island. It should be going to fix the Long Island Railroad.
Yeah, which is, you know, kind of a mess as much as the public transport is all a mess. Yeah, that there's got to be money for that. So maybe they can reach some kind of deal with that, because congestion pricing does seem to be something that is coming into being. We've seen it in London and other cities for many, many years, and it's been considered a success.
Finally, Governor Cuomo, with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi by his side, signed the red flag bill into law. What is the red flag bill?
Well, it means if you're a school official or a law enforcement person or even a family member, and you think that someone you know is, you know, said or behaved in a way that you think they might take a gun and hurt themselves or others, you can contact law enforcement, you can go to court, and you can, you know, potentially get a judge to say, take all the guns out of this person's house, out of their family's house, you know, until we know what's going on with them. That's essentially what it is. And eventually they would get their guns back, but it's a way of, you know, hopefully preventing some of the mass shootings that have been occurring all across the country.
Karen DeWitt is WSHU's Albany correspondent. Karen, as always, thank you.
You're very welcome.
And we turn our attention now to Connecticut. Ken Dixon is with us. Kenny covers the state capitol for Hearst Connecticut newspapers. Dan Haar is joining us for the first time, and I'm so happy he's here. He's also a columnist and associate editor at Hearst Connecticut newspapers. And we welcome back Sue Haig, who covers the state capitol and politics for the Associated Press. Did I pronounce that incorrectly? No, the way you were laughing. The way you were laughing at me, I thought I said something wrong, Ken. Anyway, it's good to see all of you. And Dan,
great to be here.
It's great to have you here. Governor Ned Lamont was on our program yesterday, and he was firm in what he said. He said he's not going to raise taxes on the wealthy, and the state income tax is not going to be going up. So how are progressives taking this, Dan?
Rich people are going to buy a lot more soda.
The sugary tax.
Yes. So the 1.5 cents per ounce tax, instead of raising $163 million, the secret is he's going to tell all his friends in Greenwich, buy more soda, and it's going to raise $800 million, and we're not going to need the tolls.
There are no fat people in Greenwich. You know that. They won't be drinking that. It's all got to be diet soda.
They're going to go over the line to Port Chester, just like we did to buy beer when we were underage in Connecticut.
Oh, don't admit to that. Never, never. Sue, how's it going up there? I mean, what are the progressives thinking nowadays?
I think it's just like we were talking about with New York. There is still interest in trying to tax wealthier citizens. And, you know, just because he doesn't want a millionaire's tax doesn't mean that people up here are giving up on it. But at the same time, he's getting a lot of pushback from progressives regarding a lot of his sales tax proposals, too, which they say are too regressive and will hurt the poor. So there's still a lot of debate to be had.
If you look at the $500 million in the sales tax increase, more than half of it is in the big four professional services tax, law, engineering, accounting, and real estate services. More than half of it, or about half of it, $250 million. That's not regressive. So a piece of that is not regressive taxing. I get that the sales tax is, generally speaking, more regressive than an income tax increase, but in those four instances, it isn't.
And how many lawyers are in the legislature enough to kill that, right?
Yeah, well, I was saying to a group the other day that the lawyers are going to kill that, and the accountants are going to kill it because people want to have good tax returns. So that's going to leave the real estate people who backed Stefanowski.
So
that they make the argument this is all something that will filter down to the average person. You know, the average person that buys a home or has to close on a house or needs to have a will made. I mean, they're saying that it affects, you know, the average Joe.
You said, Sue, that the progressives, you think, may still try and change this over the next month or two?
I'm just, you know, I'm guessing. I just don't see them giving up on it. There's, you know, I was at something the other day where they were applauding the idea of trying to do something with an income tax change. You know, we still, like I said last week, there's still a lot of time left in this legislative session.
Well, let me move on to something that we've talked about a lot on this program, tolls. Where does the toll plan stand now, Dan?
Well, right now, Lamont is, as you know, he's got the 53 gantry system or proposal. And I think we can stop with the ruse that the governor is in favor of either truck tolling or comprehensive tolling. It's all comprehensive tolling. And I guess he did say that in Waterbury. Is that right? That he's pretty much done with the truck only stuff. It's going to be.
I wasn't in Waterbury, but I know he's really leaning towards the.
Yeah. So this is where he is. It's
the wider.
That's right. It averages about 5 cents a mile, which is modest by comparison to some states. It's less than Florida and Texas. Some of the highways in Florida, one highway in Florida is more than 40 cents a mile on average. That's not just congestion pricing.
Did Bob Stefanowski invest in that one? Is that the one? Is that the Tamiami Trail? I think he had a piece of that.
Yeah, that's a 40 cent a mile highway. Right, yeah. Exactly. So it's not like crazy numbers like that. Now, when we hear the word congestion pricing, just to be clear to the listeners, it means that you pay more during peak periods. Mm-hmm. So the 5 cent a mile, I presume, and Sue and Ken may be able to correct me on this, is an average, that it could be much less. 2.5 cents a mile is not so bad. That means 2.5 cents a mile if you're going from New Haven all the way to the border in Greenwich is just a few cents. That's not so bad. And if you're going every day at 5-10 cents a mile, that's where it really starts to add up. But we're taking out the non-interstate highways except for the Merritt, right? 2, 8, and 9 would not be tolled in this system. And that was something that really ticked off a lot of people, was those secondary highways. So those are not in the plan.
Ken, when would the tolls go into effect?
Maybe 2023, right, Dan? 2025, well, right.
2025.
The second term of Lamont, yeah.
Possibly, right? He has said in the past, he goes, look, with everything I have to do, I may just be one term. But
who can blame him? It's like, you know, do 4 and out.
Sue, what's the feeling up in Hartford right now? Will tolls get passed?
Oh, geez. I don't make predictions. I mean, this is kind of complicated because it's more than just tolls. There's been some pushback on what he's talking about in terms of the special transportation fund that, besides the tolls, people are upset that he wants to eliminate about $250 million in borrowing for transportation. He wants to also stop the transfer of about $270 million over 2 years of receipts from new car sales. And he's making the argument that this stuff that was part of a bipartisan budget last year isn't enough to shore up the whole program. And meanwhile, lawmakers are upset by that because they say, you know, it wasn't supposed to be a long-term plan. They wanted to have something to buy them over. So it's way more complicated than just whether or not we should have truck-only tolls or tolls, how many gantries. And I mean, they haven't decided so many things, like how much people would actually pay. because they want to have some sort of a discount. And how would that apply to people who are needy? I mean, there's just so many questions. So I don't know. I don't know if it's going to make it.
And then also there are questions about exemptions, right? If you're a police officer, if you're an emergency worker, if you're a doctor going or working for a nonprofit, I've been hearing about exemptions being built into this. How is this all going to be decided? Who decides it?
The best thing to do is to just have tolls if you're going to have tolls. And Connecticut doesn't, it is complicated, like Sue says, but Connecticut doesn't need to be the most complicated state in the world on this, like we are with our liquor control laws. It can be simple. And, other states have done this. We're, in fact, the only state that touches the Atlantic Ocean, I guess if the Long Island Sound is part of the Atlantic Ocean, that doesn't have tolls. And it's enough already. It's free money. You take an $800 million toll, roughly $350 million of that is out-of-state money. So you're getting an out-of-state dividend of $360 million, to use a round number, right? You got to give the taxpayers half of that back, $160. So you cut something else, the gas tax or fees or something else, so that you make it equitable. And that's what they need to do and be simple about it.
Simple in the Connecticut General Assembly. Yeah, okay.
I don't know.
And they also still need to make sure they can get federal approval for this, too. I mean, you're asking, when is it going to actually happen? And that's still a question of whether or not the feds will okay it.
So there's a chance that the feds could actually say, you know what, you're not allowed to have tolls here?
Well, it's so complicated, and it has to do with whether or not what kind of tolls that we have. And maybe Ken can explain it more, but it's not going to be as easy as people may hope.
It's not that they're saying that you can or can't have tolls. It's that there are pretty strict rules about how to do it. And under the rules, no state can have tolling on highways that are already built. You can only toll new highways, with the exception, and Connecticut is what is it, 9 or 10 states
You put the money back into rebuilding the roads.
Right, that are in an exemption group that's allowed to have tolls on existing roads. But as you just said, you must put the money back in, and you have to do congestion pricing. You can't have new tolls unless it's either a bridge that needs to be fixed or a new highway or congestion pricing, and that's what we're going to do.
Governor Lamont was on this program, as I said yesterday, And we talked about the school regionalization proposals. So the other week, Senators Duff and Looney came out with these ideas. The outrage was palpable. People were writing into your newspapers. They were showing up at the state capitol.
Those are mostly school superintendents doing that, right, Ron?
You mean to us or to your newspapers?
The ones who are whining the most protesting about their $250,000 salaries.
It was quite the outcry. But the governor says, look, you know what? I'm not forcing anybody to do anything. I'm going to use a carrot. I'm not going to use a stick. Is he right when he says that, Dan, or is there still a stick involved?
I think what we have with this governor is neither a pure carrot nor a pure stick. I call it the voluntary stick. He's going to have to make hard decisions at some point, but he's still at the stage now where he says, I'm going to put ideas out, and if you have a better idea, let's do it. But this is a stick, let's face it. I mean, both the bills of Duff and Looney, which are very different. Not very different. They're different.
They are different.
Looney's plan would eliminate more town, more districts, because he's talking about as many as 40,000. Now I guess that's down to 10, right? But the point is that it can't be done without a stick, because the stick is you get state money, and you're not going to get as much state money anymore, and that's a stick.
Right. So it's not just a carrot, which I was having trouble to figure out when he was saying that the other day. It's still a little bit of a stick.
We don't have enough money for carrots. We got to use sticks. But it's a it's a nice stick. It's a soft stick.
It's a stick in the shape of a carrot.
Sounds like a Bugs Bunny cartoon. Sue, go ahead.
Up here at the Capitol today, these bills are up for a public hearing, and it's packed. And they see all of these bills as sticks. They see it as forced regionalization, forced consolidation. And it's not just superintendents. It's people are dragging their kids here. There's busloads of children. There's teachers. The entire House Republican caucus practically just had a news conference decrying not just the Looney and Duff bills, but also the governors. And, you know, primarily, even though projections show that this population of kids, it's still going to continue to decline years from now, for all, not just Connecticut, for all of New England, they say they don't want this shoved down their throats. They feel like they've been kept out of the discussion, and they don't think it's fair that they haven't had a chance to actually have any kind of input.
The discussion's going on now. That's why they're having a public hearing. It's like the lawmakers are going to be too afraid to do anything radical anyway.
Why did they do this now? With everything else going on, why put this out there?
Because the state has already cut spending as much as it can cut. And of the big five non-agency spending areas, Medicaid, bonded debt, health care for retirees and current employees, town aid, and pension money, those five. The one you can cut that's cuttable is town aid, but you can only cut it if the cost basis at the towns goes down. So if you force the towns to save money, you can cut town aid eventually, and that's what this is about.
Or you can make some money by letting Greenwich pay the premium for allowing their teachers to get paid another $35,000 over the average.
Yeah, I thought that until my daughter went to teaching. Now she's a new teacher, so I'm not so eager to cut teacher pay anymore.
I need her
to send me money.
Yeah, but, more part to Greenwich to pay their teachers more, but they should also accept some more of their retirement liability.
Right. We're going to get into the teacher pension mess in just a moment. Sue, in terms of the ideas or the proposals from Senators Duff and Looney, when Ken and I were speaking the other week, I think the consensus was, look, this really isn't going to go anywhere this session. This might be a good starting point, but probably nothing will happen this year. Something may happen next year, the year after, or whatever. Is that what you're hearing up in Hartford?
Well, they're continuing on as if it's going to happen this year, but it just seems like there's so much blowback that I find it hard to imagine that anything that drastic would happen. Folks at this news conference today said, you know, why not have a task force? And that always ends up being, a lot of times that ends up being the end result of something this controversial. But I just don't see the issue going away. I mean, I've been covering this place for a while, and there's been a lot of talk about how towns and school districts need to do more to, work together and save money and share resources. So a lot of times they do end up with these task forces that come up with these things. And you've got other states that have been debating this too, in New England, Vermont, and Maine, for example. So maybe I don't see anything massive happening this year so far, given this blowback. But I don't know if the issue is really going to go away.
So there's going to be a task force to study the proposal, to study the idea, to study the commission's report, to study the. So it sounds like nothing will get done. I'm just guessing.
Like I said, I don't like to make predictions, but it is amazing like what the turnout was today. And it's not just them. There's also another separate proposal you made about homeschoolers, and a lot of homeschoolers are up here today as well.
You know, I'm glad you made a distinction between consolidation and regionalization, because as bad as consolidation is to the small towns of Connecticut, regionalization is worse. And I think Bob Duff has made some effort to draw a distinction, and Senator Looney, Marty Looney as well, to draw a distinction between those two. Consolidation means two small towns need to work together. Regionalization is the really, really dirty word, which means you need to join in with your nearby big city.
And just to clarify, when they're talking about consolidation, a lot of times they're not talking about maybe merging classes. They're talking about backroom operations. They're talking about trying to save money administratively. If you're going out to buy computers, whatever, that the
getting
smaller
rid
towns
of those superintendent salaries, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So possibly eliminating some of those. But if you're going to go buy something, do it as a group. That way you pay less. Save money.
Don't forget there are regional school districts that work fine.
Right.
You know, yeah.
There are a few up around Brooklyn and they want to save money. And they say, we're already doing it. Why are you pushing us to do more? Because we're already doing it on our own.
Yeah, I was today interviewing the head of the Connecticut Association of Boards of Education. And she was saying she thinks a lot of lawmakers don't really know the extent of the cooperation that's going on already, like sharing HR or sharing buying stuff. And she said that a lot of people just don't know up here in the Capitol that a lot of this stuff is actually happening. And then some of the people today made a point that their little districts are actually spending less per pupil than some of these regional school districts. So they're saying, why are you forcing like a Wolcott to merge or to become part of like some district that they were all annoyed about? They were looking at maybe putting them in something like a probate court district that really ticked them off. They're like, it has nothing to do with the education of the child, what's best for the child. And they say that's been forgotten in this debate.
She's Sue Haig. She covers Hartford and the state capitol for the Associated Press. Ken Dixon is with us, and Dan Hart from Hearst, Connecticut newspapers. We have them for about another 10 minutes or so. The teacher pension funds. I mean, that's the 8,000-pound elephant that sits in the room everywhere across Hartford. Governor Lamont and his people say they want the towns. We were just talking about this a few moments ago. Towns like Greenwich to pay, I think it's about 25%, right, of the teacher pensions going more?
No less. It's 25%. Lamont's proposal, Malloy's proposal was 25%.
Okay.
Or was it 30? Was it one-third? I think, Sue, it was one-third, right, last year?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, one-third, not 25%. Lamont's proposal is 25% of current costs.
Current costs.
That's way significantly less. That comes out in the first year to $44 million instead of $400 million.
And it's phased in.
Right, and it's phased in. Okay. So the point is that it's a way smaller amount because it's paying current costs. They're not asking the towns to share in the sins of not having paid into the system all these decades.
They're doing it. So this will be going forward, in other
Correct.
Words. So many of the towns, so about 25% going forward. But at the meantime, if you're a distressed municipality, only about, what, 5%?
Didn't it phase out to 5 and some were 0?
Some go to actually to 0.
I think some were 0 and it was 5, but it's all. Sue, do you remember whether it was 5 or 0 for the most distressed?
I thought it was 5, but.
Yeah.
So it drops down significantly. Some of the small towns are pretty upset because they're saying, look, if we got to pay into this, that means we have to pass the costs along, which basically means property tax goes up. Is that correct?
Yeah, poor Greenwich with that 11 mil rate. Yeah, sad.
Hey, 11 mil on a $5 million house is a lot of money.
And you have those really good schools that the state's paying for 40% extra pay that you're giving them. the teachers.
Best schools in the state that nobody goes to.
So, Sue, will this be going through? Do you think this is pretty much a done deal from what you're hearing?
Like I said before, I don't make predictions.
Sue's getting whipsawed here.
I know. They have to come up with something. I mean, that's definitely the thing. I've been seeing an effort by some of these education groups or municipal groups saying, okay, if you want us to have some skin in the game, the phrase they keep using, then you got to come back with something else for us. We want mandate relief. We want something that we can save some money on. And maybe it will be used as some sort of point of leverage as these discussions continue.
Let me turn it back to transportation for just a moment. We have about 6-7 minutes left, so I want to get in two or three other questions, other topics. The 30-30-30 railroad plan, which is something that Ned Lamont ran on. And when he was running for governor, he was saying, look, this is my idea for the near future. I want everyone, because I need the trains in this state to operate quickly. They have to operate efficiently. That's how we're going to get business going. So if you get it on in Hartford, I want you to be able to get to New Haven in 30 minutes. If you get on in New Haven, I want you to be able to get to Stamford in 30 minutes, and then from Stamford zip all the way into Grand Central in 30 minutes. Is there any chance of this realistically happening in the next 10 years? Dan?
The short answer is no. In the next 10 years, but it's possible that Stamford to New York could happen. I think the other legs are tough because that's, you know, really significant work on both the tracks and the rolling stock and lots of other things. I'm working on just getting up and getting out of my house in 30 minutes. And if I can do that, I don't need the 30 minutes on the roads. But some legs are more difficult than others. New York is doing a lot of work on the so-called Hellgate line that goes through the Bronx to Penn Station. And I gather that's going to be a little bit faster. That's going to go all the way up to Stamford. So there's hope on the New York part.
The governor was in Bridgeport today with Joe Giletti, the new transportation commissioner, and the commissioner is making it sound like it could happen, positive train control and lighter cars. It could happen. He wasn't putting a time on it, but certainly out from 4 years and maybe 10 years. But he didn't have a number for it.
So there's still hope for it. Let's talk about pot. Let's talk about marijuana. Legalizing marijuana. Dan is emptying his pockets. Only kidding. The governor was on, and as Ken knows, we've done a few programs on The Full Story about whether or not marijuana should be legalized. And we've had some guests on the program who are opponents who make some pretty powerful, persuasive arguments against it. But yesterday on our show, the governor says, you know what? And the phrase that he used was, look, the cat's out of the bag. And if you're in Connecticut now and if you want to buy it, you're going to be going up to Massachusetts. But he's open to the idea of opting out. Communities, regions, towns, cities opting out in Connecticut. Where does this stand now?
Opting out? It's like, how can you opt out? If it's in the state, you're going to be able to get it wherever you want and then bring it back home. It's like these towns that had moratoriums on dispensaries for medical marijuana that now want to get back in it. It's like, buddy, you didn't get in on the ground floor. You're out of the picture now.
Massachusetts has the opt-out, and it's a big problem because obviously the market is bigger than four retail locations. They're opening up a couple more. Brookline, Boston doesn't want it. Brookline, Mass. has approval, and they're waiting for final approval, but they have preliminary approval to open in Brookline, and that's going to be the only one in, you know, greater Boston. And so you really have to have a balance between letting towns just say we don't want it and forcing it down their throats. The Colorado model is the other way around. Hmm. You know, they're on every street corner. So it's something in between that Connecticut needs to do.
So Boston does not have it.
There are no retail locations in Boston, and the city, apparently the mayor doesn't want to see it and has enough power to keep it from happening.
Are they going to build another T line to Brookline then?
Yeah, exactly. My daughter lives a mile away. It's less than a mile.
Sue?
It still seems very early in the process up here in terms of this bill. You know, I don't even think there's been a public hearing on it yet. And it sounds like it's one of those things that will have to be decided behind closed doors, like a lot of these other ones. And again, it's another issue. I just don't know if they're going to wrap it up this session. I think, again, it's got so many moving pieces.
So will this be decided?
A budget implementer, yeah, that'd be great.
Will this be decided in smoke-filled rooms?
Blue smoke. I just want to make the point that the medical market right now in Connecticut is bigger than people think. 30,000 patients as of February 1st.
And over 1,000 doctors now,
and
too.
Over 1,000 doctors. The market is believed to be up as much as $75 million a year, which, by the way, if you do the math, people are spending an average of $2,000 a year. I don't see how that's possible, but let's say it is. It's already a big piece of what the potential market would be, maybe a fifth or a sixth or maybe even a quarter of what the whole market would be. So it's not like we're not there yet in part in our borders.
Hmm. We have a minute and a half left. What should we be watching out for over the next week or so? What's taking place in Hartford? Anything that listeners should be paying particular attention to?
At this point, I'm worried that the homeschoolers might be carrying Sue off as a hostage.
Sue, anything on the agenda in Hartford that we should concentrate on?
Oh, geez. I haven't even finished up with this week yet.
Looking down the line is tough sometimes.
Well, we've got the public hearings. There's got to be a pot public hearing.
There's going to be a pot public hearing. There's also going to be a nomination approval. I just had to sit down with David Layman, the DECD commissioner to be, and that's going to be a little bit controversial, but I suspect he's going to get it. Whether that's in the next week or two, I suspect it will be.
Just so we can clarify that a little bit, this is one of Governor Lamont's nominees. He's a Greenwich resident. He used to work for Goldman Sachs, and I believe Senator Looney was holding up the nomination for a while.
Well, he's not holding it up. He's threatening to hold it up.
He's threatening to hold it up, okay. And how is that threat turning out?
You have to get into the mind of Marty Looney.
Well, the governor shopped around the nomination. He figured it wouldn't do as well in the House as the Senate, so there you go.
I think there was some surprise because this is stuff that's been gone over in books and movies, you know, famously. And, you know, nobody got indicted. There have been no accusations of wrongdoing by individuals, and that's where you get into trouble. When you have institutional problems like this, they don't usually accrue to a person who's trying to get a job going forward.
A person who was able to retire at age 40.
He didn't retire. He's working.
Yeah, okay. There was an interim. Between the election and the inauguration, he was retired.
He's getting mileage.
It's always good talking with you guys. It's a pleasure. I hope you all have a wonderful weekend. Sue, thank you once again for coming on our program.
Thank you. Hi, Sue. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Sue Haig,
who is
the reporter, the Associated Press reporter for covering Hartford and covering the state capital. Dan Haar is with us. Ken Dixon, that's our show today. Julie Ferdino is our engineer. Associate producers Christian Carter, Sabrina Garone, Natalie Chafari, Carrie Frank is the digital editor. Ann Lopez is the producer. Terry Sheridan is our news director. I'm Ron Ropiak. Thanks to all of you for being part of The Full Story.